Hi, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality, continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This month, we're looking at recent advances in glaucoma care. Glaucoma is a leading cause of preventable blindness, and its prevalence is rising as the population ages. In the UK, there's thought to be over 1 million cases. Worryingly, around half of those are undiagnosed. But it's not all bad news. Over the past decade, there have been a number of exciting new treatments, meaning that there are now many more options to delay and prevent the progression of the condition. Broadly, glaucoma management has shifted away from the binary choice between eye drops and invasive surgery. The addition of selective laser trabeculoplasty, or SLT, as a NICE approved first-line treatment is a core example of that. Even more recently, the emergence of minimally invasive glaucoma surgeries, known as MIGS, including a version of it called MIBS, minimally invasive bleb surgery, are potentially offering safer ways of reducing intraocular pressure without having to undergo highly invasive trabeculectomy procedures. So far, the IOP reductions recorded in clinical evidence suggest that MIGS techniques are well suited to mild or moderate cases of glaucoma, reserving traditional trabeculectomy to the more advanced cases. They also seem to be associated with faster recovery times, and they reduce the burden of patients having to rely on eye drops. If you've not heard about MIBS, or even MIGS, all will be revealed in this episode. We'll look at the most up-to-date clinical decision-making for glaucoma, as well as who to refer to and when. We'll also hear tips on what to bear in mind when patients have any comorbidities, such as cataract, and how to better manage patients post-operatively. This topic was suggested to us by one of our guests today, Matt Roney. Matt thinks it's really useful for optometrists to build a better understanding of all these new ways of tackling glaucoma.
Primary care optometrists are really well positioned to be able to give some advice to patients who may not be able to ask the questions that they want to when they go to the hospital. I think really plenty of patients could be coming to primary care optometrists to ask these kind of questions.
Matt Roney is the clinical lead in optometry at the Royal Liverpool University Hospitals. He's also doing research for a PhD on long-term patient success following glaucoma surgery. Matt's with me to explain what optometrists need to know about these new treatment options.
Historically, a lot of people have thought that the treatment of glaucoma is either drops or glaucoma surgery such as trabeculectomy. So I think this is a really good conversation to have.
Also joining me is his research supervisor and clinical colleague, Neeru Vallabh. She's a glaucoma consultant and a lecturer at the Liverpool University Hospitals. Neeru and Matt, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you for the kind invitation.
Also echo the very kind invitation, so thank you.
So Matt, it's a really exciting time for the management of glaucoma because there has been significant progress in the development of new procedures such as MIGS or minimally invasive glaucoma surgeries. But just to put that into context, can you tell us what else has been happening in glaucoma management in the last 10 years?
In the last 10 years, SLT has become much more prevalent and much more used. And that's because in January 2022, NICE came along and said that SLT should be considered to be the primary treatment for newly diagnosed glaucomas and OHTs. And that's because of some really pivotal studies, particularly the LIGHT trial. Also, there's been other drops that have been in other countries for some time, but they've been brought across to the UK market, such as Notarcidil, which has been combined with latanoprost at the moment. And that is a combination drop that's used once a day. With regards to other options, which certainly Neeru is much more specialised and experienced in talking about, is minimally invasive glaucoma surgery and minimally invasive bleb surgery. And you can almost think of this almost like a ladder, in a sense that you can start the ladder where the clinician feels though it's most appropriate. But you can almost kind of think of it like drops in SLT, then moving up to minimally invasive glaucoma surgery, potentially even minimally invasive bleb surgery, and then up to non-penetrating surgery such as deep sclerectomy, up to trabeculectomies, and then tube surgery.
So Neeru, from your perspective, what do you see as the main change that MIGS has brought about?
Yeah, so I think the benefit of the treatment is that it gives patients an option to have an alternative treatment from what they previously had, which was just drops, one drops, two drops, three drops, four drops. And then they would have to potentially then wait until they'd advanced to a later stage, at which stage they may then need these more invasive surgeries. So it's given an option to have surgery with a minimally invasive approach with these smaller devices. It's done ab interno and it preserves the eye for the long term for other types of surgery. So it provides another method of treatment. The key point of these treatments are to get patients off these drop therapies, which we know have their own side effects, whether that be irritation or redness of the eyes, hyperemia. And these things can often deter patients from using their drops regularly. And so it helps to reduce the drop burden for them so that they can have this minimally invasive glaucoma procedure.
And there are different types of MIGS as well, aren't there? So Matt, can you dive into a bit more of the detail?
So essentially, it's trying to enhance the outflow mechanism of the eye. And it's most of them are done in the angle itself. So they're creating essentially a new passage through the trabecular meshwork, or it's taking away a layer of resistance within the trabecular meshwork to try and improve that outflow mechanism. Now, that's typically for MIGS, so minimally invasive glaucoma surgery. The other option is Neeru touched upon, MIBS, also known as minimally invasive bleb surgery, that creates a new pipe out of the eye. You can almost think of it like a tap and a sink. And we know that with glaucoma, the tap isn't the problem, it's the sink that's the problem. And in open-angle glaucoma, it's because the plug is out the plug hole, but there's a blockage further down the pipe. MIGS and MIBS are almost like creating a new pipe out of the eye, but particularly MIBS, whereby you're creating this small to medium-sized pipe out of the eye. And that creates this area called a bleb, which is, you can almost imagine it like a balloon that collects aqueous underneath the conjunctiva. And typically we locate this superiorly, and that certainly means that the eyelid can cover it, so it's not as visually impactful for the patient from a cosmetic perspective.
Neeru, there are a wide range of devices out there now. So can you explain to me, what is the difference between the different devices?
Yeah, so the umbrella term really is minimally invasive glaucoma surgery. And so there are different groups within that. So the first one is trabecular or Schlemm's canal-based surgery. So essentially what they do is they try to improve the eye's own natural drainage pathway. And so some of these bypass the trabecular meshwork. So this can include the likes of iStent or Hydrus or Elios, and some are canaloplasty procedures whereby they go beyond the trabecular meshwork and they sometimes inject a gel to try and dilate the canal. So that includes iTrack, Advance, and Omni type procedures. So there's trabecular bypass and then there's Schlemm's canal dilation procedures. Another group is the suprachoroidal drainage procedures. So this used to be the CyPass stent, which was actually withdrawn because of corneal endothelial cell loss. But we now have what's called a mini-ject device, and there's also now the Ciliatech uveal scleral drainage outflow device as well. So they're trying to create an opening from the anterior chamber and improve suprachoroidal drainage and flow. Then there is minimally invasive bleb surgeries. So these actually do then create a bleb for drainage from beneath the subconjunctival space. So in a sense, it's less invasive compared to a trabeculectomy because you're not needing to create a large flap and ostium and the high numbers of sutures that are required for that. But what they do is they bypass fluid from the anterior chamber to the subconjunctival space using a smaller device. So this includes the Presaflow microshunt and the Zen gel shunt, which are used as methods to try and reduce the pressure. But studies have shown that it doesn't quite get as high pressure lowering as, for example, a trabeculectomy. And so this is where really, as you can appreciate, there's multiple different types and the conversation needs to be had about what's required for the patient, what's the target pressure that they need, and then this can be decided what's the most appropriate type of MIGS or MIBS for that patient and their management.
Yes, because the different devices have different strategies of reducing the pressure. So I was wondering, how do you actually decide which strategy to choose when the patient's sat in the chair in front of you?
Yeah, and I think that's where looking at their disease severity, looking at their angle status, and then sometimes conversations with the patient. So some people don't like the idea of a stent or an implant. Some of these treatments are implant-free as well. So that's where it's a matter of chatting to the patient to decide not only what they require from their management point of view, but also their preference together with the evidence that's available.
So would the age of the patient be a factor as well?
The benefit of some of these, for example, if you were comparing some of the subconjunctival drainage procedures to, say, a trabeculectomy, in terms of the duration of the surgery itself, in terms of the recovery from the procedures, it can be quicker for the patients and less involved. Some patients may not be able to lie flat for a full longer procedure, for example, and a quicker, shorter procedure may be more beneficial. And if the target pressure isn't as low, then you may opt for one of these. The other important thing with all of these newer procedures is that we don't have the long-term data compared to the likes of the traditional glaucoma surgery. So the reality is, although we may have potentially up to 8 to 10 years, we don't know the longer term effects beyond that, and only time will tell which is the most beneficial from that point of view as well.
So Neeru, in community practice where we are seeing patients that we suspect might have glaucoma, has the referral criteria changed in any way in the last 10 years because of the range of therapies that we now have available to manage glaucoma?
Yeah, I think now the benefit is the introduction of OCT imaging, both in secondary care and also in primary care. And I think that's sort of helped to enhance our case finding for patients, and it allows us to kind of visualize if there's any loss of the ganglion cell layer, which might suggest that they have early glaucoma, which sometimes the cup to disc ratio may appear quite normal, but actually the scans can show much more subtle pre-perimetric changes. So although that hasn't changed the referral criteria, which is still similar from a NICE guidance point of view, it does help to kind of raise questions of patients that may need more intervention, for example, and need to be reviewed further. So I think from that side of things, it's important to be confident with evaluating those scan images and the changes that are observed to try and help improve the referral. And those scans can be sent to us as well. We find them quite useful to evaluate the OCT scans and help to provide a bit of dialogue, potentially. For example, we decide that the patient doesn't need to be seen, we can say and reassure based on the scan findings. And those can also then be monitored in the community, which is beneficial.
So the referral criteria hasn't actually changed that much, but it's just a case of OCT provides us with more evidence, and that evidence can be used to help us make the right clinical decision in terms of referral or not, or monitoring.
Yeah, and I think from the referral side of things, it's been more the kind of use of enhanced case finding schemes or repeat measurement schemes that have been beneficial to determine those who are truly glaucoma suspects rather than sporadic single high readings. So that's really helped to improve the quality of referrals that we receive, which is fantastic. And I think the recent Getting It Right First Time document that's been released specifically looking at glaucoma care also advocates that, to help provide information which we can then use to determine if these patients need to be reviewed in clinic.
And in community, sometimes we do see patients who are under glaucoma management but are struggling with their eye drops. So they're still being managed and their glaucoma is under control, but they are struggling to use their eye drops. Maybe it's because of handling, or maybe it's because they're developing an ocular surface disorder. In situations like that, is it still worth referring back to the clinic? Because they could still be considered for one of these other therapies, such as MIGS, couldn't they?
Yeah, I think that if somebody's really struggling, we can actually do an SLT treatment, even if they've just been on drops and potentially that conversation hasn't been had in the past, or they declined SLT previously. We could turn around and say, actually, we recognise that this is really difficult for you. Maybe we could talk about SLT again, and they may wish to have that, and that may again be another way to get them off drop therapy, or like you say, to go and have minimally invasive glaucoma surgery.
I think another thing which Neeru is alluding to is that primary care optometrists could really be a good port of call, in a sense of, let's say for instance they're on one medication and it's got preservatives in, for instance, and they come with a bit of a sore, irritable eye. You could write back to the hospital and say, you know, the pressure's great, but the eye's a bit irritable. I've given them some preservative-free topical lubricants, but I also wonder whether it's worthwhile considering changing their formulation to a preservative-free medication. So I think, once again, this just is all about creating dialogue and having those conversations between primary and secondary care.
And if we are referring to glaucoma services, Matt, you're on the receiving end of these letters quite often. What do you think should be included in a referral letter?
Yeah, that's something that I talk to optometrists about. And the things that I talk about, they're quite surprised at what I think should go into a referral letter. But I think the things that are really important to put in are things like their age. So, you know, a 50-year-old patient versus a 95-year-old patient could be treated very differently. I think also ethnicity is something that should be mentioned in a referral letter. We know that certain ethnic groups are at higher risk of developing glaucoma. So, for instance, open angle, you know, Hispanic, African, Afro-Caribbean are at higher risks. The depth of the anterior chamber on a Van Herica estimation. So we know that open angle glaucoma versus closed angle glaucoma is a very different urgency of referral. We know that primary open angle is a routine referral, whereas primary angle closure glaucoma is an urgent referral. So I think anterior chamber depth is really important to mention. And we're not saying whether it's open or closed, because you can only really do that with anterior segment OCT or gonioscopy. So it's an estimation of depth using Van Herrick. I think also the optic nerve head analysis. If a optic disc is 0.9 cup to disc ratio with thin neuroretinal rim all the way round, that's something that we want to see really, really soon, because that patient could be at risk of sight loss that's irreversible versus someone who's got a 0.4 cup to disc ratio with very subtle inferior loss. I think the urgency of wanting to see them in secondary care is very, very different. And that also alludes to what the functional capacity is like. So we've talked about structure in a sense of the optic nerve head appearance, but also how is the visual field? They're the things that I think are really important, but also pressure. We all want to know what the pressure is. We all measure it every single day. And that's what me and Neeru do day in, day out. So yeah, we definitely want to know the pressure. And if you're able to do so, do it with a Goldman. Goldman is still considered to be the gold standard of pressure measurement at this point in time.
What about visual fields? Is that something that you want to know what kind of testing we've done?
I think it's really important to know, are you doing a 24-2, or are you doing an FDT, or are you doing a screeno? I think it's also really important, if you're able to do so, attach those visual fields to the referral. That gives the triager at the other end a really good opportunity to understand how bad the suspicion of glaucoma is, and it means that they can prioritise them if they're needed.
And just thinking, does the potential for MIGS surgery influence how a community optometrist should refer for cataract surgery?
I think the key thing with referral for potential MIGS is sometimes patients are being seen regularly within a glaucoma service, and sometimes they go to the optician and they've noted that the cataract has progressed, for example. And so then they may sometimes get referred to a different treatment centre for their cataract surgery, which is a missed opportunity to do potentially a minimally invasive glaucoma surgery. So I think the important thing is that these patients, if they're seen in the community and you know that they have a long-standing history of glaucoma, my strong advice would be to go back to the glaucoma team and say that they've got cataracts, they could benefit from cataract surgery, but also please do consider whether any other treatment is needed at the same time. Because it may be that if they've got secondary open angle glaucoma, or if they've got an advanced glaucoma, a minimally invasive glaucoma surgery may not be enough for them. But really, that should be done by the glaucoma specialist together with their minimum data set and their longitudinal clinical data set to really establish what's needed for that patient. And I think what I'm really pleased to see is that the Getting It Right First Time document released recently also emphasizes this. And so did the survey of the UK and Air Glaucoma Society. Again, people felt that patients should be referred back to their glaucoma specialist for treatment with minimally invasive glaucoma surgery at the same time, if it's deemed appropriate.
As you say there, from my perspective, I think if your patient has got high pressure inside the eye and you think that they've also got a cataract, it's the pressure that needs sorting first, really. If a patient comes in presenting with raised pressure and with a cataract, I would refer it to a glaucoma team. And certainly, I think the patient might ask you, are they going to take the cataract out? Can they combine it with something else? And I think that's something that the optometrist can advise and say, well, yeah, they might choose to do a cataract operation along with a small procedure at the end to try and lower the pressure as well.
So certainly if someone is already diagnosed with glaucoma, the referral would be different compared to someone who hasn't yet been diagnosed and just have a raised pressure or other signs of glaucoma. That is the priority to get sorted first, as you say.
For sure. And I think the thing is that in glaucoma management, sometimes we don't see the patients in the hospital for 2 years. But let's say, for instance, their cataract has progressed in 6 months since they were seen and they're now symptomatic. You're well positioned to write back to secondary care to say, this patient's got glaucoma, they're on these medications, but now they've developed a visually significant cataract. I wonder whether it's worthwhile having a cataract operation. And I wonder also whether they would benefit from something else to lower their pressure, but also to reduce the drop burden associated with their glaucoma treatment.
It's about having that conversation with the managing department, isn't it? Because, as you say, they don't have the means to follow up patients on a very regular basis, i.e. every 6 months, to track these things. So sometimes you do need to step in if things do change.
And I think that's the key thing. It's a conversation, you know. It's about creating that dialogue between primary and secondary care. I think that's really important.
And do you think, realistically, the waiting time for combined surgery is significantly longer than just simple cataract surgery, or do you think it's more on par?
That would kind of depend on the unit. For example, in my unit, we have cataract surgical suites, so the routine cataracts are done within that service. And there are some glaucoma specialists as well who will also do cataracts together with MIGS in that space. But in some places, I do know that because they'll have to go back to the glaucoma specialist, it will take longer. And I think when you compare it to some of the independent service providers, yes, it would take longer, but that's where it's a missed opportunity not to do something more at the same time for their glaucoma management. So it's worth counselling the patient of that, that although this may seem like a longer wait than, say, some of your peers may have in other providers, it's important for you that you're seen in the correct place so that you get the correct treatment at the same time.
And I guess by having that conversation with the patient in the first place, you can make sure that you refer to the right unit in the first place and minimise the delay. Because obviously, if they were referred to an independent provider first, by the time they're seen, that could take several weeks or a couple of months. And then they're being re-referred to a glaucoma service, so that delays that patient journey by a couple of months. So it's best to get the referral going to the right place in the first place by having the conversation with the patient and giving them the options.
Yeah, exactly. Because it may be that actually, if they had the opportunity to come off one or two drops to make their life easier and simpler, it may be that they go and see the glaucoma specialist and the glaucoma specialist decides together with them that actually you don't need a minimally invasive glaucoma surgery. Just cataract alone may be enough for you. The realistic thing is that the patient should have that conversation with their specialist to decide that in order to make sure they get the optimal care that they need.
So Matt, in the future, or maybe not so far in the future, maybe in only a few months' time, there'll be an increasing number of patients that are coming into community practice having had MIGS surgery. What kind of things do optometrists need to be aware of? What should they be looking out for when they're assessing these patients?
I think the first thing to say is that not all glaucoma surgeries you can see. Some of these procedures insert small, tiny, tiny little stents into the anterior chamber angle that you can't see without a gonioscope. So I think that's the first thing to be mindful of. Try and understand what the patient has had with regards to glaucoma surgery. You could even ask to see a letter from their most recent glaucoma consultation. I think the other thing that always instills some dialogue requirement is things like post-operative inflammation, CMO, high femurs, but also raised pressures. You know, there are some times whereby the intention of minimally invasive glaucoma surgery is to reduce the drop burden, to lower the pressure. But sometimes when we stop these drops, the pressure can go up a little bit. So I think if the community optometrist finds that there's any post-operative complications, you can either send a letter, or the other thing that you can do is, depend upon your concern, is you can always pick up the phone. There's always going to be someone at the other end of a phone at the hospital. They may not be able to answer the question there and then, but they should be able to get back to you fairly soon. So I think there's some things that are worthwhile keeping at the forefront of your mind when you see these patients after MIGS.
And so it does sound like this is a really exciting time for patients in terms of glaucoma management. So Nero, can you give us an idea of what might be coming in the future?
I think the future mainly is about personalization of treatment for the patient. So, for example, there's polygenic risk scores, which is where the DNA can be analyzed to try and determine patients who are at a higher risk of developing glaucoma sooner and who need more regular monitoring and likely earlier intervention compared to those who potentially are OHDs and maybe lower risk and may not need to be seen. But these are all being done sort of in a research-based setting. From a minimally invasive glaucoma point of view, there are even some that have sustained drug release delivery. Although those are being used within the US, they haven't come into our facilities in the UK. But that may be something in the future from a treatment point of view that will be beneficial for patients. We're improving our imaging of the angle and also the outflow pathways. And this is allowing us to get a greater understanding of the biology of what's happening for glaucoma. And so I think the pipe dream would be that in the future, what you would do is you'd be able to determine where is the site of resistance. So is the site of resistance the trabecular meshwork? And so then trabecular bypass, minimally invasive glaucoma surgery is going to be ideal. Is it that they have a completely collapsed Schlemm's canal? And so then what you should do is you should viscodilate the canal. Or is it that both of those factors are not working well? And so you may want to do suprachoroidal implants. So I think what we need in the future is to help us to determine which minimally invasive approach is most beneficial for patients. And hopefully the technology will continue to improve from that regard. And then I think, as we all know, the big buzzword of the era is AI. And I think even from a glaucoma point of view, AI will be beneficial from evaluating images, fields, and OCT scans to kind of determine and predict rates of progression, which will allow us to then personalize the care for the patients even further. But this, again, is all in very much experimental research-based settings, and it hasn't really been delivered into our clinical practice and management for patients just yet. So lots to come on the horizon.
Yes.
But when it comes and how it'll be delivered, only time will tell.
So lots to look forward to. And Matt, just to finish off, we've come full circle, really. You are keen to cover this topic. What do you want optometrists to take away from this conversation? Something that, actually, having listened to this podcast, they're going to go and do it maybe slightly differently in practice tomorrow.
Sure. I'm a keen advocate for communication. Communicating between primary and secondary care is really, really important. And then I think the other thing, as we talked about, the referral letters, that's a real key opportunity for optometrists to contribute from primary care to the care that the patient receives, in a sense that it tells the clinicians at the other end in secondary care, this is how soon you probably need to see this patient. You know, not going along and saying you need to see this patient in a week, but in a sense that this is the age, this is the severity of the disease, this is the pressure. And that allows clinicians at the other end of the computer to make the right decisions in a sense of when they see the patient in a hospital. So I think they're really the key things to take forward from today.
Neeru, Matt, thank you both very much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. If you head to docits.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. By completing the short exercise on our website, you can gain one CPD point covering professionalism and clinical practice. We're now taking a break for the summer, but don't forget to check out our back catalogue of 60 sound optometry episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast app. I'm confident that there's plenty of content to keep you educated and entertained over the summer. Sound Optometry is produced by Dr. Hilary Guite and Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks very much for listening.